will crypto regulation shape the future of traditional financial services? Welcome to Global Risk Regulator's podcast series about banking and financial regulation. For more about GRR, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. This episode delves into international developments surrounding the regulation of crypto assets and what this is likely to mean for mainstream financial services. It will be a whirlwind tour encompassing the EU's markets and crypto assets regulation, what the UK is likely to do in this space, and a glimpse at the currently confusing US situation. It also comments on the consultation by the Basel Committee on bank exposures to crypto assets. Global Risk Regulator has covered crypto regulation and central bank digital currencies extensively. If you're not a subscriber and would like to take a free trial, please contact my colleague Ella Jacob at ella.jacob@ft.com. To share insights into these regulatory developments, I am delighted to welcome Yves Longchamp, Head of Research at CIBA Bank, a Swiss bank providing a bridge between traditional and digital assets. I'm also very pleased to welcome Lavan Thassanathakumar, the Regulatory Affairs Director EMEA at Global Digital Finance, an association advocating for digital assets. There is a general consensus that decentralized finance, or DeFi, will not replace traditional financial services and firms. However, most believe it will have a profound impact on those firms. Lavan, can you give some thoughts on how DeFi might change the industry?
Well, I think this is actually something that is very similar to the discussion that we had when there was the rise of fintechs. There was a whole question on who is going to prevail here. Will it be the fintechs or will it be the incumbent banks? And as we're seeing now, the answer was not that one will displace the other, but in fact, there is a convergence. We'll see that incumbent financial institutions are transitioning from their legacy systems or partnering with fintechs, or the two coexist. And I think that's something that's very similar in the DeFi industry and what we're seeing here. What the similarity is that what fintechs offered, what DeFi is offering is the provision of faster, better, cheaper, and more efficient financial services. And I think that's what we're going to see, is that traditional financial services companies will start adopting some DeFi protocols, as we're already starting to see, as the kind of businesses and the world of finance start move on to this next plane.
Yeah, no, I must admit, I do like the fintech analogy very much. That's a very good one. And Yves, what is your view on how DeFi might shape mainstream financial services? Because, I mean, you're kind of quite involved in that yourself.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for the question. I think the way I see it is more like there will be a sort of complement between this kind of new decentralized finance and traditional finance. In my view, what happened with DeFi, it's a kind of commoditization of finance. So you can do the simple stuff. I mean, for the time being, lending, borrowing, all the exchange of assets, it proved to work, which is what we have seen in the last 12 months. Yeah. And as Lavan mentioned, obviously you have huge advantage because it's fast, it's cheap, and the rules are clear. You see, the code is low, and there is also a kind of settlement system which is included. So it's T+0. It's instantaneous. So I think that there would be a sort of merge. But I think that, on the one hand, I think that banking, or let's say traditional financial system, will benefit from DeFi, especially when we think about these simple solutions.
Yeah.
But for more complex financial transactions, I think that we still have time and we still need to have a traditional finance. And on the other hand, I think that DeFi, to go to the next step, we need to have institutional investors that can literally open the door to other institutions, meaning that institutional investors that do the KYC, AML, all these kind of usual checking to kind of whitelist participants, and then you literally open the DeFi to a new space. And I think that as long as we don't have digital identity, banks have also their benefits. So I imagine that both of them will work together.
Yeah, no, those are all very good points. If I can stay with you, so as we develop this topic a bit more. So Eve, maybe you could take this one up first. It looks probable that most jurisdictions will introduce central bank digital currencies at some point in some form. Will that be a game changer for mainstream financial services, given it is a kind of a central bank's answer to cryptocurrencies? I mean, does this actually potentially also help traditional financial services against DeFi?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a game changer. But I mean, in my view, the interest of central banking to use blockchain is manifold. I mean, on the first, on the pure technological level, as an infrastructure, central banks has always been interested in finding better way to, you know, use the infrastructure to propagate monetary policy. And this is quite clear that blockchain is one of them. The second thing is they do observe that stablecoins are getting more and more important. If you look at the ranking in terms of market capitalization after Bitcoin and Ether, the third biggest capitalization is US Tether, which is a stablecoin, which is about $62 billion. So it's quite massive. And this is outside the reach of the usual monetary policy channel. So you would like also to be able to be closer to that. And I think that to have a CBDC, central bank digital currency, is the way to bridge this new world. And so for that point of view, I think that central bank need to go into this direction. And finally, then if we go back to the idea of DeFi is finance. And we know that central banks have been created, first of all, to help finance. Finance is a very fragile edifice. We all remember global financial crisis, and no one pretends that the DeFi space will be stronger than that. So if it becomes big and attracts a lot of capital, there may be some vulnerabilities, and you would be happy to have some lender plus resort or buyer plus resort, because it's likely that, let's say, the frontier of traditional and decentralized finance will become more and more blurred, and then you would be happy to have central banks, let's say 2.0, which have the ability with central bank digital currency to inject directly 24/7 liquidity into the system. So in my opinion, CBDC is quite good, and I'm very much welcome that central banks goes into this space as well.
Well, yeah, that certainly does spell out some hints at how it could be quite radical. I mean, Levan, if I can turn to you, do you think CBDCs might prove the saviors for conventional financial services? No doubt it will still have a big impact on them, whatever happens.
Yeah, so I wouldn't use the word savior as such. I'd say it's more a facilitator for financial services to evolve into this next plane that we're referring to. So I think traditional financial services and the crypto industry will have a role to play in this. And you know, I think as Eve mentioned in his previous comment, I think the infrastructure around this is the most important thing. And I think that is the biggest benefit that comes out of having CBDC. Well, in this context, the likes of having digital ID and digital wallets, these are all vital. These are all vital components that I think will start to bring people into the ecosystem, that will allow for new products and services to be created on top of this. And I think that's the kind of exciting thing about this. So it wouldn't necessarily be a savior of traditional finance, but something that will kind of allow both traditional finance and the crypto industry to move into this new plane.
Right. Okay, great. Okay, Levan, I know this is an area you've been focusing on a lot. So, you know, let's turn to the regulatory challenges now. Now, crypto is a new area based on, you know, decentralization, automation, and it's creating all kinds of new approaches to traditional financial activities. Obviously, it's also evolving incredibly rapidly. So, in your view, what are the regulatory challenges in terms of balancing financial stability and consumer protection issues without stifling innovation? And also, is there anything that can be learned from more developed crypto regimes from countries such as Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and Singapore, for example?
Yeah, so I think it's always a difficult one, and I think you've said it there, that whenever something like this happens, the difficulty is really trying to find that line between ensuring the consumer protection, financial stability, and market integrity aspect, but then also recognizing the importance of promoting this competition and innovation, which in of itself lends a hand to providing those protections as well. Yeah. And I think one of the difficulties that occurs in this industry is the decentralized aspect of it. Now, our existing regulatory regimes are all very much built on there being a central entity that is held accountable, and the decentralization aspect of this makes it quite complicated. I don't think that, however, from a regulatory perspective, this is insurmountable. I think actually what needs to be put in place, and I think what has been done well, or the kind of trajectory that we're going in, is building out clear frameworks on how to regulate this industry. And I think that is something that is very important and something that addresses the activity that is taking place rather than being sidetracked by the technology. So I mean, a lot of the rhetoric around this is having a tech-neutral approach to regulation. And I think that's something that we've got to persist with. To address your point about, is there something else that we can learn from other crypto regimes and some of the other jurisdictions you talked about? I think the important thing that we need to pick up from this is it's not just a framework that we need to create, it's the ecosystem. And what I mean by that is you can have a framework in place, but it needs to have the buy-in from the whole ecosystem to facilitate that framework. So the regulators need to know how they are supervising this regime. The industry need to know how to apply the rules. But then once that is done, you also need to, the industry also need to have, for example, access to bank accounts and a clear understanding of their tax liabilities. And this ecosystem is what will allow crypto to prevail and allow us to build a kind of framework that is more effective.
Right. Okay. All very good points there. Eve, let me turn to you. I mean, you already operate under one of those developed regimes, i.e. the Swiss one. So you've got some experience of that. I mean, Switzerland is seeing that very ecosystem developing. What is your take on the best way to protect investors and financial stability without hurting crypto innovation?
I fully agree with what Levan said, and I think it's very difficult because the way regulation has been created so far is all about one central authority. So you need to find someone, you need to have an institution. Because this is decentralized, so regulation doesn't exist, and we don't even know how to do it because nothing happens to us. And this is the difficulty. I mean, the difficulty is that there are many different actors in this kind of big ecosystem. You have for the consumers.
Yes.
You protect it. So this is kind of normal. You have it everywhere. You have also, if you want to regulate it and to develop it and to develop DeFi, or all the blockchain application, you need to take institutions with you, which means that you need to pave the way for institutional adoptions so that finance of tomorrow can use DeFi within their toolbox and not outside. You know, I think it would be completely counterproductive if you regulate it in a way so that you create two types of financial system. I think that would be the worst. I think you also need to take care of monetary authority. We just mentioned it with CBDC.
Yeah.
You see, it depends a lot on the type of country, the monetary authority you have, the capital control. So think about China, for example. And finally, as both innovation, this is, you need to take a new actor into it. This is the cyberpunk community or the developers, or who, I don't know how you want to call it. But they are people which are all around the world. We may not even know their real names, and you need to take care of them and not to put too much responsibility on their shoulders.
Okay.
And I think when you want to have all these elements together, given that blockchains, applications, and cryptocurrency are developing fast, we think that, you know, CEDAR in Switzerland, the heart of the crypto valley, that Switzerland did something good, which means starting early, regulating, and doing it step by step. Because you cannot sail faster than the wind. You know, you don't know exactly how it goes. So you need to create something, to adjust, to monitor, and to react. And so this is our main take about Switzerland's of the experience it has, and that can be useful for the future for different countries.
Yeah, I mean, I know from conversations we had, I know you're saying that FINMA are quite helpful and supportive, in developing crypto products and so on. But okay, well for that's great. Thank you very much for that. So let me now turn to specific regulatory initiatives. So the EU's Markets in Crypto Assets Regulation, or MiCA, is bound to be very influential even beyond the EU's borders. So, Levan, can you describe some of the good and bad points about MiCA and its likely impact on crypto becoming mainstream? Hi, Levan, are you there?
Sorry, I pressed the mute button. Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the key things about MiCA is that it is a comprehensive framework. And I think looking at the commission proposal that had come out in September of last year, it's clear that they left no stone unturned in their analysis of this. And it comes off the back of a lot of analysis of existing financial services legislation and its applicability to the crypto industry. And I think the most effective thing on this is that it's a regulation. It applies directly to all members of the EU and the EEA, in fact. And it means that there is a single rule book for crypto industries to follow to move across this whole market. So I think in that sense, it is a fantastic piece of initiative, a great piece of legislation to allow crypto to kind of move cross-border as it naturally does and develop across the EU. I think perhaps some of the shortcomings of MiCA is that, well, on one side of things, it was, I feel, largely prioritized by the de-emphasization.
Sorry, Levan, you broke up there for the last couple of seconds. Sorry, did you mind repeating that?
Sure. So I think one of the shortcomings of MiCA was that a lot of the discussion has been railroaded by DM. So a lot of the focus has been...
That's Facebook, stable currency, isn't it?
Facebook. That stablecoin, yes. And I think one of the difficulties there has been that the discussion has been largely focused on that and kind of not taking a broader view of the whole industry. That's reflective of the process of how the process has developed in the discussions in both the Parliament and the Council as well. But I think one of the kind of more fundamental parts, and I think from a kind of process and procedural perspective of what MiCA is that it's a subsidiary piece of legislation. So this is a piece of legislation that applies when all other EU financial services legislation is disapplied. And I think this makes it quite complicated and and costly for new market entrants, because they will have to ensure that they do all their analysis to ensure that, for example, they are not in some way covered by MiFID.
Yeah.
Before they then have to do their analysis on whether they are within the remit of MiCA and therefore what rules they have to follow. And this is quite a costly process. And I think that something that can be improved on this is if this process is streamlined. So an example that I give is the crowdfunding legislation. So arguably that crowdfunding can fall within the remit of existing financial services legislation. It could be deemed as a collective investment scheme, for example.
Okay. But
it has its own ring-fence piece of legislation that crowdfunding platforms can operate within this legislation, and everything else is disapplied. And that, I think, allows there to be greater clarity and a streamlined process for the market to really, really evolve and kick off. And I think that arguably this framework could benefit from that.
Right. Okay. Well, some interesting points there. So, I mean, Eve, what do you think about MiCA and its potential impact abroad? Maybe even its ability to influence Switzerland once it's in force.
Yeah, I mean, Levin summarized all the main points, so I don't have much to say. I think,
okay,
as well, it's kind of comprehensive. It's pretty much detailed. But the good news, it's really unifying, say, all the existing framework, create some kind of legal certainty as well. It should enhance market integrity, financial stability, so we see that as positive. It's maybe just 2024 seems to be far away when it will be really applied.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it could be a bit dissuasive by, you know, because it's happening right now. But that would be, let's say, the negative side. But I mean, just an add on to what Levan said. I fully agree with what he said, and I don't have anything else to add to that. Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. No, okay, well, move on to the next question, which is probably more for Levan anyway. So, if Levan, if you could go first on this one. Following Brexit, the UK is revisiting its regulatory frameworks. We've had the Khalifa review on fintech, Lord Hill's recommendations on the listings regime, etc., etc., etc. But in terms of crypto, I'm hearing some disappointments about the UK's approach so far. A lot of people complained about the Financial Conduct Authority sitting on applications, for anti-money laundering purposes. So, Levan, can you share your thoughts as to how the UK might approach this? Is the UK likely to mirror MiCA, for example, or will the UK authorities go down the road of a more principles-based framework, as is often their instinct, actually?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the kind of important things on this is, as I said before, that crypto is borderless. There are no kind of jurisdictional boundaries as such. And I think we've got to be cognizant of that when we're building a framework. So to answer your question of whether we'll mirror MiCA or whether we'll go our own way, I think the important thing is that either there is the buy into MiCA and have some sort of alignment there, or there is address some of the shortcomings that are in MiCA and build global kind of alliances in that sense, so that there is this kind of universal approach.
Yeah.
And to address the kind of first part of the question of the UK not necessarily being perceived to be doing much in this area, I think there is a lot of activity that is taking place. So the Khalifa review, for example, did highlight the role of crypto in its recommendations, the role of crypto in the future of finance, as well as also the importance of CBDC. And we're seeing that through, there was the Treasury consultation paper on stablecoins, the call for evidence on DLT-based financial markets infrastructure, DeFi, security tokens, and then from the FCA, the discussion paper on financial promotions, for example.
Okay.
And I think, and more recently, there was the discussion paper on from the Bank of England on the future of money. And the thing that I find very reassuring from this is the how these things are all tying together. There seems to be strong coordination between the Bank of England, the Treasury, and the Financial Conduct Authority. As you'll know, there is the task force as well to deal with this. And what's reassuring is the rhetoric that's coming out is also the almost the understanding that there is going to be an interplay between stablecoins and CBDCs. And therefore, there is almost a deep analysis that's kind of coming out of this on what the interaction between the two will be. And also, there are some very promising indications that there needs to be a proportionate regulation that understands the risks that stablecoins have. So kind of not necessarily having this quite weighty regime, but instead something that is put in place to facilitate stablecoins. So I think there is a lot of analysis that is going on behind the scenes, and I think that the UK are putting attention towards this, and I think that we're starting to see this come through.
Right. Okay. Well, I must admit that does sound like quite a positive take on the train of direction this the UK is going in anyway. Eve, do you have any thoughts about the UK's approach to regulated crypto assets? I mean, maybe in your discussions with people in the industry, you've maybe heard comments about it, or if you have your own views, maybe.
Well, I mean, what we actually all view inside the bank is that the UK has started pretty early tackling this issue. As far as I remember, I think in the early 2015, it started with this AML check for crypto exchanges. And
okay.
It literally started all the process, and it worked step by step. I would say a la Switzerland, so to say. And almost every year, you get an addition. You know, you have some kind of warning on ICO. And you have also the FCA regulatory guidance, you know, clarifying the crypto asset handling. There was also this ban on crypto asset derivatives from retail investors, and this is something that we have seen quite a lot in the media, for example. There are also proposals to regulate stablecoin, and this is something which is developing. What we very much like in this approach is actually two things. The first one is, again, this kind of step-by-step or ongoing development. And the second one is that we think that UK is using a sort of a technological neutrality approach.
Okay.
Which means that, you know, if you have something which is on DLT, on digital ledger technology, that actually have the exact same feature as any other asset, then it means this is the same asset as it is on traditional basis. And we think that this is something which is very good to for promoting blockchain approach. And finally, UK Financial Monetary Authority remain quite influential, also globally. And obviously, they have some concern, which is fine. I understand them. But fundamentally, they seem to be supportive for that. And if we have this kind of authority, which counts globally, that support the idea, I think that will definitely help other countries to join the development and to come with some regulatory solutions for blockchains and crypto assets.
Okay, well, that's also a very positive take there. Okay, well, look, Eve, let me stay with you. As you know, the situation, so just shifting to a completely different continent now, as you know, the situation in the US is quite confusing, particularly compared with the EU's clearer approach with MiCA. So, you know, some US policymakers clearly remain suspicious of all things crypto, You know, you've seen some of the lawsuits there. They do send quite mixed messages. While other policymakers, they clearly see an opportunity for the U.S. economy from crypto. So, Eve, do you think the U.S. eventually will craft a unique regime such as MiCA, or do you think they will simply adapt their existing regulatory frameworks? And would there be any upsides or downsides to that approach in your view?
Yeah, that's a key question. I think I fully agree with you. It's confusing at best.
Yeah.
There's a mix between, let's say, federal and the state-based regulatory system, so that you don't really know where you go. And it definitely adds confusion. There is no unity, so it's not unifying as MiCA is doing, for example.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not only an issue in the US, but we know that the US is setting the tone for the whole world. And with all these impacts, this international impact, I think it's complicated for the rest of the world to know where it has to go. So we hope that at some point in time, there will be a unifying force behind these regulations. And I think that will be a major change. However, what we seem to observe is that this kind of a state-based regulatory matrix seems to be the way the US is working. And we don't really see the top-down development. That said, there are some nice development. The last 12 months, you know, in the US, it has been pretty quiet on the crypto markets. There have been a lot of projects, but I think in terms of regulation. However, we have seen that the Feds, for example, the OCC, this Office of the Controller of the Currency, the FDIC, seems to be collaborating and preparing a sort of a joint cryptocurrency regulatory framework. So we hope that it will again kind of set the tone or, you know, give an idea of where we go. We have seen also that the SEC has reported there was some regulatory gaps, and it doesn't look like that. And they would like to propose something so that exchanges where you can trade crypto are regulated in the very same way as, for example, the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. So something is coming there, and we like that. We hope it will come soon. But the problem is there's still no clarity, and we need to have a clear oversight. We are in a sort of a wait-and-see situation, and this is very uncomfortable. And for us, it's important that the outcome of this process will be absolutely key to shape cryptocurrencies regulation globally. This is why we wait for the US, because the US plays a central role, but it's not as clear as for the UK, as for Europe, and as for Switzerland, obviously.
Yeah, no, well, that's a very good roundup, actually, of what's going on there. I mean, Levan, what do you think about the US situation and whether they'll tailor or come up with a bespoke regime?
So I think from my perspective, the US is unlikely to propose something on lines of MiCA, at least in the near term. And the reason why I say that, I don't think that there is enough internal or external pressure to seriously consider that at this stage. And where I come from on that is if we draw a parallel to the EU and the GDPR coming into force.
Yeah.
And there are kind of similarities there. The GDPR in many ways deprives the US of leadership on privacy. It's only after that there was kind of serious consideration of a federal privacy law. But even still now, there isn't really that kind of traction and getting that. We're still waiting for it, and it's still quite some way from adopting it. So I think if we were to draw that parallel, we'd see MiCA come into force, and there would be that kind of external pressure, which then brings the internal pressure to develop something, but we're very far away from that. In the meantime, I think what we'll see is that adaption of existing regulatory frameworks which will in some ways be quite a piecemeal approach, but as you would do from not having this kind of overarching framework.
Yeah.
But the upside to that would be that you would get something that was done relatively quickly, albeit it's the tendency is on the adoption of existing regulation is that the rules that come into force are quite restrictive as a, for example, kind of taking on a stronger approach on AML, as opposed to doing something that is kind of more kind of enabling that certain kind of frameworks that could be implemented would be doing in the crypto space.
Right. Okay. Okay. Thanks for that. Okay, Eve, if I can come back to you then. The Basel Committee recently put out a consultation on the prudential treatment of cryptocurrencies and stablecoins by banks. Now, it gives cryptocurrency exposures the highest available capital weightings and even advises potential capital add-ons for certain stablecoins, even though they might be backed by traditional assets. Now, if these recommendations come into force, how will that shape the approach banks take to crypto and the type of crypto services they go on to offer to their clients and even their own sort of proprietary activities in crypto, maybe?
Yes, we obviously have been very interested in this release, and if it comes, that will be impactful for the financial industry. As you mentioned, you know, we see this idea of Pillar 1, different types of way to get liquidity. And indeed, when we mentioned the idea of what they call other crypto assets, could be Bitcoin, Ether, but also all the DeFi tokens are, let's say, part of the worst category you can ever imagine.
Yes.
So it means that actually you have to have a 1,250% risk-weighted capital, which is extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's clearly mean that there's not strong support or confidence into this kind of assets. I mean, for the other two, let's say for the good news, because there are still some kind of good news in this report.
Okay.
If you think about tokenized traditional assets, so you just tokenize anything, the Pillar 1 solution should be roughly the same as we have with some kind of twist on the top of that, which should be slightly more expensive, but not so much. And also for stablecoin, because stablecoin are not as good as, let's say, standard electronic form of fiat money, but they will take a sort of a haircut, you know, according to the different stabilization mechanisms. But the fact is, at least this report recognize the sort of ineluctability of asset tokenization and stablecoin, which is obviously good. But again, for the rest, for other crypto assets, Bitcoin, Ether, DeFi, and so on, it's a sort of a very kind of a one-size-fits-all, harshest possible capital charge. And it has broad implication indeed for the banking system, because it's very costly to offer these kind of solutions or, you know, all kind of cryptocurrencies and token, because it costs a lot in terms of balance sheet.
I mean, so, okay, so, you know, a bank considering moving into this space, Eve, I mean, is that going to sort of, when it comes to, okay, I guess certain stable coins, they'll be able to participate in those fully, but maybe cryptocurrencies, maybe it will just what providing custodian services, a trading platform for customers, i.e. all things where the bank is kind of standing aside. Is that what you think will happen as a, yeah, if this goes into force?
I mean, so we see there are really big names, and I don't want to mention that, but we saw all
yes,
the big...
Yes, they've all been, you know, in the press.
Exactly. They are all the big investment banking of the world. They are entering into this business. You know, I think that they see that as a sort of lucrative business. They want to enter into it. But, I mean, they don't want to do it if this would be banned tomorrow. So they also believe that this technology will remain, and the cryptocurrency, which are associated to this technology, are part of, let's say, a new asset class. But I think that the way this will be, you know, let's say, accounted within the bank should be different. So most of the solution will be off balance sheets.
Okay.
In order for banks to survive, because if you, you know, if you have to, because at the end of the day, the clients need to pay these fees, you know, because this cost, that is something that would prevent anyone from using all the regulatory environments, and that would definitely incentivize non-regulatory exchanges, which doesn't mean everything is illicit, right? Yeah, I don't say that. But
yeah.
I think it will, in a way, I'm wondering whether this is not counterproductive to do something else. I understand there is a high volatility, and I think we have seen that recently, just with the price of Bitcoin,
yeah.
And it makes sense that it's more volatile than government bonds, so and the liquidity is not the same. But I think we have to be careful with that. I get that the solution for the time being is to find an off-balance sheet situation, for example, creating SPV or ways to make your balance sheet, the bank balance sheet, pretty light and not too costly to manage.
Yeah, no, that's totally understandable. Okay, Levan, what do you make of the Basel recommendations? And secondly, how do you think banks will end up responding in terms of the crypto services and their sort of involvement in the crypto space?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with everything that Eve said there. So most of what I would say to that would echo what he said. I think, you know, first of all, I think kind of pulling out the positives on this is that, well, at least there is an approach on this. There is something progressive on this, as opposed to a banning from holding crypto assets, which is a positive. And then, as you say, the kind of two tranches that we look at here, the first, which allows, which kind of treats almost the kind of tokenized assets in the same way as the traditional assets, with, as mentioned already, with a slight kind of add-on. But it's the second tranche that is the one that certainly from global digital finance perspective is quite concerning, in the such a high risk weighting being applied here. And I think what we need to take into consideration also is that this is a consultation process, and I think there will certainly be a lot of response, certainly from GDF, and I'm sure a number of different...
I'm sure there will be, yes.
to kind of temper some of this approach and kind of make sure that it is a more proportionate approach. Because as you've said, the impact of this, the thinking behind this is also these kind of protectionist measures and consumer protection, but ultimately the people who will be paying for measures such as this would be the clients. It would just be passed on in many ways. So to what extent is it counterproductive? So I think we'll see how this consultation process goes, and as I say, we'll be engaging with that to see to ensure that a more proportionate approach is taken.
I mean, just unpack that slightly more before we move on. I mean, Eve mentioned about banks taking a sort of balance sheet light approach, maybe setting up SPVs. That kind of sounds a bit like shadow banking. So, you know, if this comes to force, Levan, do you think, you know, we could see a sort of shadow banking sector evolving, you know, around it, which you know might not be quite what the regulators want?
Or perhaps I think it is very much dependent on where the industry moves on this. I mean, we're actually seeing something quite similar being set up in the US at the moment with the custody of digital assets. The intention on that is for a separation of the custody of traditional assets and that of digital securities. And so those who currently hold traditional securities will have to set up an SPV to hold the digital securities. And I think the thinking behind that, and certainly that approach from the SEC at the time, was very similar to the approach that we saw when there was the kind of moving on to from kind of traditional commerce to e-commerce, there was this the not wanting to cross contaminate the two exposures, and therefore there was the separation of the two, the e-commerce and the traditional commerce businesses. And once there was once the things had settled down and there was a greater understanding and more comfort around subjects, the two were allowed to combine. And I think also, as Eve says there, if the two were to separate, and kind of there was the kind of creation of an SPV to hold this, I do think that it would be more of a short term thing.
Okay.
Until there is the kind of comfort around the subject.
Right. Okay. That's lovely.
Justin?
Yes, go ahead, Eve.
Yeah. So, sorry. Yes, I think it's a good point. The way I present it sounds a bit like shadow banking, but this is not what I wanted.
I didn't mean it like that, but it's just a thought that crossed my mind, that's all.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to shed light and not to cast shadow on this banking system. And I think that I need to precise a bit myself. I think there are two different ways, and Lavan actually kind of mentioned it. I mean, for issuing, let's say, ETP or these kind of financial products, an SPV is definitely a good way because the assets are outside the bank. They belong to, let's say they are fully backed. So the asset, the financial product you offer is fully backed. And I mean, everyone's very happy with that. There is another way because you typically have a crypto bank, like the bank where I'm working, you have clients coming with their own crypto assets. Then what we would propose is to have a custody solution like cold storage. And this is back on the blockchain, like, for example, if you own a share, you know, if you have a deposit account and you have the share you have, you own them. They are not on the balance sheet of the bank. You know, they go bankrupt, it belongs to you. And in that case also, you make your balance sheet a bit lighter. There are definitely two ways. The first one is SPV, or financial products. The second one is to use cold storage for, physical assets, even though it's quite clear that cryptocurrencies are old but not physical.
Yeah. Okay. Well, no, fair enough. And you know, thanks for the clarification. Actually, Eve, if I could stay with you. Moving to the last question now, which you know, you got the highly influential financial action task force, which is consulting on guidance on a risk-based approach towards the treatment of crypto assets for anti-money laundering purposes. Mm-hmm. You've got other key global standard setters such as the Basel Committee, we're just talking about that, and you've got the Financial Stability Board. They're all sort of looking at crypto as well. So Eve, how do you think those bodies, those global standard setters, will shape the mainstream adoption of crypto across the world?
Well, I think their impact will be huge, definitely. Yeah. But they have to be careful the way they do it. And I think Lavan mentioned it, some questions ago, saying that, you know, the problem is regulation. This is linked to, we are used to a central regulation. So you need to have someone to regulate or to blame. And when this is decentralized, you have a decentralized financial protocol, a decentralized application or smart contract, you don't have anyone. You don't even know who is behind.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
That's a big problem. And then this is all the problem about how to update guidance. It's a risk-based approach to virtual asset and virtual asset service provider, this sort of VASP. And what we have seen with this financial action task force consulting that, you know, you cannot apply the current system to peer-to-peer transactions because it doesn't work. There's someone missing in between. So you need to find a way. And because you cannot potentially charge a smart contract, you need to have to look who is behind it. And I think that the risk is that the owners of the dApps, or the controller, the operators, or all the developers of the DeFi applications are actually the VASPs and are at the risk of being, sued in case there's some kind of illicit transactions. And this is definitely not good, because if you prevent these people from doing that, in particular because you don't, they do not provide, or there is no way for the time being to check correctly, you know, who is bringing money.
Yeah.
So you don't have proper KYC, AML, and so on. And I think that's, this is what I said at the beginning, I think that it could well be the case that the very beginning, I mean, from now on in the next few years, until we get a proper digital identity, then banks or any regulated financial institution providing proper KYC, AML, and CFT checks to whitelist participants. And then, in a way, that this traditional financial services open the door to the decentralized finance, creating, let's say, white pool, or I don't know how to call that, when you know that all people using the DeFi applications, you know, are kind of people that are allowed to do it. And I'm just wondering whether we should not, this is not something where we could go. But the risk is indeed the way as it is to prevent more innovations.
Yeah.
Because the guys which are behind codings are definitely not bankers or lawyers and so on. And it's probably too much of a risk for them. So I think that's a major concern. Maybe we can find a way with banks. And the most elegant solution, would be now your digital identity, which I hope will come soon. And this is something to see in the future.
Yeah, those are all very, very good points, actually, Eve. Okay, well, Levan, you know, what is your take on how the global standard setters might shape use of crypto by mainstream investors and financial services going forward?
Well, I think they play a vital role here. So as I'd mentioned before, I think the thing that we need to consider in all of this is that crypto is borderless, and therefore having these jurisdictional measures that are different is counterproductive in the overall aims of building these frameworks and protections. So I think they play a very important role in setting these standards that will be adopted by supranational organizations and member states. And I think if we look towards the Financial Action Task Force and what they've been doing in AML on this matter, I think that is a clear indication of the role they play and the influence that they have. So it's Yep. manifested itself in FIRE AMLD and the incoming AMLR in Europe, for example, and creating these standards. And I think that is they play a very important role in shaping where we go in this industry.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Levan and Eve for taking part in Global Risk Regulators Regulatory Podcast Series. And if you'd like to listen to more regulatory podcasts, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. And you can also subscribe to our podcasts via Acast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy this, please do share it. And finally, I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.